This is episode number 787 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Terrificon, Hack Slash, and what's next after Secret Identity for Matt and Brian. Our comics this week will be Amazing Spider-Man number 29, Secret Empire number 5, and Venom number 150. And our summer reading project continues this week with more Case Files of Judge Dredd. We're going to be talking about the Lunar Olympics and Laurel and Hardy.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful, the slightly tired today, Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well, except all I'm hearing out of my right ear is,
I know. You know what the sad thing is? Did we ever talk about the fact that I have like low-level tinnitus?
I probably do. It's so low-level, or I've just been so used to it. When I keep piling on the new stuff, it doesn't doesn't even faze me.
I started wearing earplugs probably a year and a half, 2 years ago now, because it was getting worse. And obviously that's the ringing in your ears that you get when you listen to music too loud, and it can get progressively worse.
Yes.
And so I now wear earplugs, and my son also wears earplugs, much to his chagrin, although he's fine with the ones that I bought him, because we went to see Iron Maiden last night.
Iron Maiden and Ghost, and holy crap.
Great show.
Amazing.
At Great Woods, which is a fun venue to sit inside of and watch a show because it's very packed and there's a great vibe to it, but logistically a nightmare to get in and out of. Like that, to me, it's amazing that places are designed like that. And there's so many of these music venues that we go to that are designed so poorly for getting in and out of, but this one really takes the cake.
It seems to be, if you're on that stretch of, is that 495?
Yes.
If you are a mega site of a venue of any size on 495, which is basically, if you don't know the geography of Massachusetts, if we live in Western Mass and we're driving to Boston, maybe a half hour before we get to Boston, we crank a right and then we start heading towards Cape Cod, which if you don't know Mass, we have a little hook. That's the little hook. So as you're driving there, you've got Foxborough, where the New England Patriots play, in the middle of this town that should not have a stadium that big in it. It's a great place when you're in there, but it's one road in, one road out.
Yeah, it's
and
like unbelievable.
Mansfield, where we saw a great
same thing.
Where we saw the band at the Xfinity.
It's now the Xfinity Center, but it is Great Woods to everybody that's ever lived around here forever. Just like the one in Hartford, which is Xfinity Theater, is the Meadows.
Still the Meadows.
Yeah,
and you have a hill that you go up off the exit, and it's really quick. It's quick. You're in it. You can park really quick.
Sure.
However, the bad part is it is one dirt path that keeps everybody in line getting out.
Yeah, brutal. Absolutely brutal. But great place to see a show when you're actually in it. So that was super cool. And it's ironic, Matthew, because we are starting off our discussion here on the latest episode of Secret Identity talking about music.
Yes.
If you listened to the last episode of Secret Identity, and shame on you if you did not, then you may have heard us say that we are wrapping up this podcast for good with episode number 800. That will be the last episode recorded of the Secret Identity podcast. And but if you enjoy hearing Matthew and I talk about stuff on a regular basis, then I have good news for you, because we will be doing another podcast that will be rising from the ashes of Secret Identity, and it will be based on our discussion and love of music.
Yes.
So clearly anybody that's listened to this show or knows us at all knows that I would say our passion for music is light years above and beyond our passion for comics. And we're pretty passionate about comics.
Yes.
But music is our first love. And so, the next show that we're going to be doing is called the Power Chords Podcast. And if you're listening to this on Friday, our intention is to have the first episode of that podcast up on Monday. And you can go to powerchordspodcast.com, and I'll put a link in the show notes where you can find out more about the show and you can get a link to the first episode. We will be up on iTunes. We will be up on Spreaker. But if you take the template for Secret Identity and you apply that to 70s, 80s, and early 90s bands and rock and roll, then that's pretty much what you can expect from the Power Chords Podcast.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we think about when you're just talking about how music has been such a passion for us, maybe more than anything else, when I think about why I love music so much, I cannot remember a time in my life where music wasn't around. It's always been there in my house.
Same.
My parents are huge music fans, and I discovered my love of Motown from my mother, and the hits of the day from her. My father was a big folky, so I listened to a lot of that, plus the country rock stuff that came up. My sister, who was 3 years older than me, introduced me to all the cool bands when it was cool for like a seventh grader to know some of these bands. Like a seventh grader who knows Frank Zappa and is into Frank Zappa, that's a notch above everybody else.
That's a street cred for you right there.
And so when I would read comic books, I would have music on. When I was sad, I would have music on. When I was getting dressed in the morning for school, music on, in the car. So as much as we love our hobbies, music is that thing that always kind of is there, no matter where we are. When we get in the ride, the only time we don't normally listen to music, and I don't, is when I go to a concert and come home from the concert. I usually listen to sports radio or at least some talk radio just to kind of get out of that. But we used to value and love our long trips because we'd pop in, we'd each bring a couple new CDs.
Yep.
And we would just share them off and listen. And that was the other big thing, was I was that kid in school that everybody would come up to and say, who's the next big band, or who are you listening to? And I was listening to such outrageous stuff because I was reading Kerrang magazine, which is a British music magazine. And I was reading that and hearing about all these British bands. I was into Guns N' Roses like a year. I had Live Like a Suicide,
yep,
their EP. I had that a year before Appetite for Destruction came out, simply because I read about it and saw, you know what, I'm going to give those guys a try. And I would turn people on to bands, and it was hysterical to think of the, you know, Guns N' Roses. I remember playing, I don't like them. So I always love doing that, and that's where I think with Power Chords, I think that's – you and I are going to be able to do that. Like, I get to try to push music on people that they might not have already heard.
Right. The goal for that show is to celebrate music, to reminisce about stuff that we loved and still listen to, and to talk about bands that we grew up listening to who are still putting out music today and new stuff as well. So it's going to be very exciting. You'll hear more of this origin story of our love of music on the first episode of that show. So if the last 3 minutes, as you've just listened to this, sound good to you, then I think you're going to like Power Chords. If you're rolling your eyes because we're talking about music again, then I hate to tell you that that podcast is probably not going to be for you. But we would love for everybody to at least give it a chance. And we are starting up that podcast as we are winding down Secret Identity. So we'll probably mention it a couple more times and talk about that a little bit more. But we are here today, Matthew, to talk about comic books and comic-related news and whatnot. So let's first give our plug for the upcoming Terrificon, which, as you listen to this show, is happening on the 18th through the 20th at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut. We will be there doing panels. There will be many of our friends there selling books and hanging out, and they will have guests at this show, such as Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis, Kurt Busiek, Stan Sakai, Peter David, Chris Giarrusso, and many more. On the movie and TV side of things, Dean Cain, Finn Jones from Iron Fist, Echo Kellum or Mr. Terrific from the Arrowverse, Violet Bean or Jesse Quick from the Arrowverse, and Shannon Purser, who not only is Barb from Stranger Things, but is Ethel from Riverdale. And again, those are just partial lists of the guests that are going to be at Terrificon. That show gets better every year. It's going to be amazing. My son, I took him and his buddy to Six Flags the other day. And of course, we went to the Hall of Justice and we were meeting Flash and Batman and stuff like that. And my son, who's been to Terrificon a couple of years in a row now, was telling his buddy about, oh yeah, this year we're meeting, you know, Jesse Quick, and we're going to meet Mr. Terrific. And who else are we meeting, Dad? Oh yeah, yeah, and this guy too, and stuff like that. So he is now the coolest kid on the playground because he has signed pictures from these guys and has met these guys and stuff like that. So one of his friends is going to be coming with us this year for a day to get to do that. But that show is just super fun. And what I love most about Terrificon, for the whole family.
Yes. And there is like five or six major selling points on the show. First of all, you have a great guest list. You have creators there that when Mitch Halleck, who's the promoter, puts people into these shows, what is really cool and, you know, what is really shows you where his heart is, he will reach out to us, friends of his, and say, hey, I'm thinking about bringing this person. Do you think they're a good fit?
Yep.
Or, you know, hey, I've heard some things about this person and what do you think? He wants to have it be everybody there is wanting to be there and that they're good people. And he's done a great job doing that. You mentioned the family aspect. It is such a family show. You don't have to worry about walking around and seeing things that you don't want your kids to see.
But also that there's activities and vendors, yes, and creators there that are for them too.
Yep.
So there's always something for them to do there. And that's another thing I love. So we end up seeing, because our table is usually out in the big, you know, sort of walkway there.
Yeah.
It's families cosplaying together.
Yeah, we saw a lot of that last year. And it's a lot of fun to see that. So the selling points that Brian and I always really go insane over. Number one, carpeted floors the entire place through. Now, you might not think that's a big deal, but when you're standing on it or walking on it for 3 days, it is a joy.
It's a big deal.
Number two, free parking. Cannot stress that enough. You pay for your ticket for a show like Boston Comic Con, and then if you're going there for 3 days, you're on the hook for another maybe $200 just to park. So you don't have that there. It's free parking. And when you're at the show and you're walking around and all of a sudden you start to get a little overwhelmed and just need to kind of get out a little bit, you walk out in the casino area, you go through the casino, and then you go into the mall area where there are restaurants that can feed anybody cheap and restaurants that are expensive. You get everything right there.
Yep.
So you can escape the noise, escape the clutter, escape all that stuff, go catch your breath, and then come back. Or my favorite, if you got stuff and you got to run to your car isn't 900 miles away.
Right.
Bring it to your car, come back, you're all set.
So if you're going to be in the area on the 18th through the 20th of August, then bring the family down, stop by and say hi. We'll be doing panels. We'll be talking more about it before the show comes up, but we're excited about that. Here's another thing I'm excited about, Matthew.
Mm.
The return of Hack Slash.
I saw that.
Image Comics will launch a new chapter in Tim Seeley's Hack Slash series, Hack Slash Resurrection, with a new creative team on October 25th of this year. Hack Slash Resurrection will be penned by Teenie Howard of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, Pink, and the Skeptics fame, with art by Silor from Zombie Tramp, which is over from our friends at Action Lab.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know he was doing the art.
Under the Danger Zone imprint.
Wow.
And K. Michael Russell of Hack Slash, Son of Sam Hain, and Postal. The first issue cover will be provided by Seeley, with variants by Jim Rugg and Stefano Caselli, who... all-time Hack Slash fantastic artist. Yep. Cassiac has been living quietly for a while now, but when a new threat arises targeting promiscuous teens, Matthew,
again,
as often happens in the slasher universe, Cassie's picking up the baseball bat again to combat the monster. Hack Slash is the book people always ask me about, said Seeley. I've been waiting for the proper time to bring it back, but I wanted to make sure I had the perfect creators first. Now that I have them, it's time to unleash Cassie Hack on the world again. Question for you, Matthew.
Yes.
Because we both are Hack Slash fans.
Love
going back
book.
A long way. What do you think of this? And Tim Seeley is not the only creator who has made this amazing property and then gone on to let other people play in that sandbox. What do you think of that? Like, what do you think of the fact that he's not the one who is bringing back? Clearly, he's pretty busy with a lot of the stuff he's doing at DC and elsewhere. But how do you feel about that sort of thing?
It's funny because I'm on the fence on – I can go either way on it. And I think it really depends on the property and depends on the look and style of the book. Like Hack Slash, I got introduced to it by the covers. There was an Iron Maiden Killers cover, and that was the first one I bought.
Right, right.
I bought it just for the cover. So – the covers were always so much different than the interior art. So if you had some different artist doing it, it's not going to throw me that much. The last series that came out, I think Tim Seeley just wrote it and it had different art, but the feel was there and I really liked it. If you had somebody, if Stan Sakai told somebody, you know, hey, Alex Ross, go do Usagi. I love Alex Ross, but I don't want Alex Ross to go near Usagi.
Right.
And I had this with Danger Girl. Danger Girl was one of my favorite series when that was a big, big hit, J. Scott Campbell's art. And they did a couple series with an artist, and I don't remember who it was, but the style wasn't even close. I think Phil Noto did one, and Phil Right. Noto was great. But it really took me out of it because, to me, the identifying characteristic of that book was J. Scott Campbell's art.
Right.
And then they found somebody that did a couple of the series afterwards that drew just like J. Scott, so it was okay, and it kind of smoothed it out. But I think with Hack Slash, you're not – at least I wasn't in love and drawn into the art. It wasn't the art that drew me in, and it wasn't the art that that was my love. So I thought the stories were great.
I think – it's a situation-specific sort of thing where there are – I'm trying to think of a series that, like, I would not want someone else writing it. And for me, it is the – whoever the creator is that sets the tone for those characters and establishes those characters, that's the piece that I worry about losing, mm-hmm. right? So I think of a book like Giant Days, which I talk about all yep. the time, and is the characters are so perfect and the writing is so wonderful. I don't know that I would like someone else – taking over that series.
Greg Capullo is going to do, and he's not. Greg Capullo is going to do Battle Pug.
Right. Exactly.
You know, that's where you're, Greg's an amazing now, artist.
And that's cool for yeah. a one-off, right? Where, oh, we're doing a one-shot, we're doing a annual issue or something like that. We're letting other people jump in. Hack Slash is, to me, so unique because it is based on such cliches.
Yes.
Right? It's unique in its approach to cliches. But basically, that series and those characters are a love letter to 80s slasher movies, which are so near and dear to my heart. So the entire premise of the series and the entire series itself is an homage.
Yes.
Now, having said that, the fact that Tim Seeley has written enough of those characters that he has established for Cassie who she is and what are the rules that sort of define her and what is her core identity, I feel like there's enough there to work with that if he's overseeing it, someone else can come in and has before. This isn't the first time that other people have written these characters, but that some people, as long as he's still involved, I would hesitate to see him not be involved at all and just kind of let other people take those characters in a completely different direction. But make no mistake, I'll be getting this series.
Yes.
Because it's the return of Hack Slash, so I will definitely be getting it. But it's always interesting to me when someone creates something, especially an indie creator, who this is not them working on Spider-Man or working on Fantastic Four or working on the Justice League where it was already somebody else's stuff. This is your stuff. Yeah. So if he has enough faith in the new creative team, I certainly can have enough faith as a reader to pick that up. So I'm excited.
Yeah, and it was funny because I read that story, and then last night, after coming back from the concert and not being able to sleep right away, I watched maybe 45 minutes of Friday the 13th Part 3.
Part 3D?
3D, where the dude got his head crushed and the eye came popping out.
Yes, and
on the
porch.
You
could clearly see the wire
yes.
come out of it, which is awesome,
because
which I love.
The great thing is high-def television and big-screen TVs are awesome. Except for stuff like that, because the flaws are bigger.
But the flaws only make them more awesome in my mind. And the thing that I love about that is because it was part of the 3D craze at the time.
Yes.
Every camera angle is trying to emphasize the 3D coming at you. So there's a lot of shots of like the machete slowly approaching the camera straight ahead yep. so you can see it coming at you. And that is really cool. And the third movie, I would say, while not in my top third of the movies, it's certainly not terrible compared to some of the other ones.
To me, it just keeps going because I did see two a little while ago. I missed one. I have them all, but
one is the one that everybody should go back and watch because obviously it's his mother.
And one is a straight horror movie.
Yes.
That is – you could put that one right up there with The Omen.
Kevin Bacon, arrow through the throat, never gets old.
Hold, look and wonder what the drip was on his head.
Yep.
You know what, dude? That's the least of your problems.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. That's such a great moment in slasher history. I absolutely love it. I'm going to go back and watch it. I have the whole series of them on DVD, and I also have Jason Goes to Hell, and I also have Jason X, which takes place in space and is totally underrated and awesome. The only one that we don't talk about, Matthew, is the 2009 pile of garbage that was yes. the reboot. We don't speak of that.
Yep.
My daughter watched that on Netflix, and she's like, Dad, I watched that Friday the 13th that you were talking about. It was terrible. I said, what do you mean it's terrible? I don't know. It's the – oh, you watched the crappy 2009 reboot.
You are grounded.
Yeah, exactly.
Go to your room for a month.
I said, you got to run those things by me first before you watch. Yes. I will steer you in the right direction. So there you go. That's your news for this week. Before we get into talking about comics, though, it's time to talk about facial hair, Matthew. And I was glad yesterday when we were at Iron Maiden and I was sweating.
Yes.
Sweating that I had my Viking Oils beard oil, that my beard was well taken care of, because when I sweat like that in the midst of the summer, it usually dries out the skin on my face and it dries out my beard. And that is not happening because of these awesome products. And I have solidified, as I was at the show yesterday, that this beard is not going anywhere anytime soon.
No, it's not.
I don't care what the haters say. The fact that my wife hates it, the fact that my kids hate it, the fact that everybody that I work with hates it. I don't care, Matthew.
That is the book of the dead of beards right now.
That is right.
And I was noticing yesterday at the show, a lot of people that I saw could have used a little bit of Viking oil because there were some unruly beards all over the place.
Unruly. And I really, I'm not going to say that my beard is super amazingly groomed, but it's got a look, Matthew.
It does.
Here's what I don't like. I don't care for the, I just woke up and I don't give a crap about my facial hair.
Yep.
Look, I'm not a fan of that.
Nope.
Like, I mean, have a take, you know, have an angle on it.
Yeah.
Crying out loud.
And then a couple of days ago, I got in the car to go play softball. I left work early. And as I hit the highway, I get the text that says game's canceled. Great. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go home and shave. So I came home and shaved. And most of the reason it was I went back to work at Amazon. We shut down for about 2.5 weeks because we had a new building put in and everything is new and I was exhausted. And usually when I don't feel well or I feel out of sorts, my face just doesn't feel right. So I shaved and I'll grow it back. That's kind of the fun right now. But the best part was, since I've been using Viking oils, after I shave, I don't have any breakouts. I don't have any blemishes. I honestly have not cut myself shaving since I've been using Viking
oil. You don't look
oil.
Like there was a reason that you grew a beard and it was to cover up whatever was underneath.
Yes, I mm-hmm. love that fact. I think to me, that is a huge selling point.
It's important.
You are seeing what's underneath the skin.
And it looks beautiful. I'm going to attest to everybody here.
Thank you.
I said it at the top of the show. I'm going to say it again at the top of the comic book reviews. You look beautiful today.
VikingOilsLLC.com. Like them on Facebook.
Makes you look beautiful.
Yep.
All right, let's get into comic books, Matthew. And as I've mentioned before, I'm behind.
Yes,
I'm always behind in my comic book reading, but this was a book that I needed to talk about. Amazing Spider-Man. Everybody knows, diehard Spider-Man fan. I knew the secret, what is it called? Secret Empire?
Mm-hmm.
I knew the tie-in was coming. I knew it was going to be happening.
It's hitting all the books right now.
So when I picked up issue number 29 of Amazing Spider-Man and saw the little Hydra-y star in the corner, I was like, oh boy, here we go. Now this book is going to get bogged down in this. However, I was pleasantly surprised on a number of fronts. I think the last time I talked about Amazing Spider-Man, it was when Peter had helped Silver Sable mm-hmm. claim back her country from Hydra,
yes.
basically. And so we pick up in issue number 29, in the aftermath of that, Peter is in London because there's a Parker Industries outpost in London, and he's there with Anna Maria, who I will say again, is probably my favorite character that Dan Slott created during his run on Amazing Spider-Man. I absolutely love this character. So she's there and she's saying to Peter, remember, this interview is about damage control. Parker Industries was just involved in what essentially turned out to be a military operation because you partnered up with Silver Sable and Spider-Man was part of it and Parker Industries tech was part of it and you guys were involved in a conflict. We got damage control to do. We're a public company. And so Peter is on set and she's saying, look, whatever happens, don't say anything stupid. And you can't go running off in the middle of the interview like you always do anytime something happens. So just kind of hang in there and do what you're supposed to do. So she reads him the riot act. He sits down with the reporter and the reporter saying, you know, what kind of company are you running? You know, last week, one of your products was linked to mass cases of nausea and discomfort, which was the whole clone thing. And now this week you've privately funded a war. What the heck's going on with Parker Industries? And so he says to her, hey, look, we took action to stop terrorists and spread of a deadly virus. So if you're saying that Parker Industries values people over profits, well, I guess then we're guilty as charged. And every time he says something, he looks over at Anna Maria and she's giving him like a thumbs up or a, you know, watch yourself sort of thing. They interview Silver Sable and they interview Aunt May, who's heading up the Uncle Ben Foundation. And Parker Industries kind of ends up coming off looking pretty good throughout this discussion. But there's a part where breaking news comes in the middle of the interviews and says, Alpha Flight space station's under attack and there's aliens attacking and all this kind of stuff. And you can see Peter start to get out of the chair. And he looks over and Anna Maria gives him the sit down look because he was about to run off. And so he ends up making it through the interview and the company ends up looking pretty good. So they leave there and she's telling him that he did a great job. And she's talking about how he needs to drop her off because she's going to go meet her boyfriend or whatever. And he says, all right, well, I'm going to swing by Parker Industries and just see how everybody's doing. So he goes over to the building and it's after hours and his spider sense is starting to act up. And so he decides to get in his Spider-Man garb because Spider-Man has been known to provide additional security for Parker Industries from time to time. So he kind of goes into the office and he's saying, hey, everybody, you know, nothing to worry about. I'm just doing a sweep before I leave for the evening. Wanted to say hi to everybody. And he's walking around and he's like, huh, I don't recognize that person. I don't recognize that person. Where's Gerald? Where's this person? And all of a sudden, one of the employees says, he's on to us. And as soon as they say that, everybody starts attacking Spidey and yelling, Hail Hydra, because Hydra has infiltrated the London offices of Parker Industries. So he ends up battling for pages all of these Hydra agents, fighting them, beating the crap out of them. And in the midst of the battle, someone comes over the intercom and basically says, leave them alone. All personnel clear the building. Hold the perimeter. I'll deal with this. And so Spidey's like, huh, that voice sounds kind of familiar, but I can't quite place it. And he ends up walking up to the CEO's office where he runs into the newly remade version of Dr. Octopus. Now, we know that Dr. Octopus, Otto Octavius, shared a brain with Peter for a while. He even took over Peter's body for a while. And then in the whole clone saga thing that just happened recently, he ended up putting his consciousness in a brand new body. And he has basically aligned himself with Hydra for the moment so that he could take advantage of their technology and everything and made himself a brand new suit. And it's pretty awesome, Matthew. I will show you other people.
Oh, I like the colors. I like the black and kind of silvery white.
Well, and there's some Hydra green mixed in there too. So he basically confronts Peter and he says, you know, I'm surprised it took you this long to figure it out, you know, but as we've stated before, I'm superior to you. So they get into an argument. And Peter's saying to him, look, I know you because I've been in your head. There's a part of you that's good. Why are you working with Hydra? Let's team up and let's take them down. And Doc Ock is saying, Hydra's going to have its day coming pretty soon. And so that's why I've aligned myself with them for now. But I'm really here because I wanted to give you a chance to turn over ownership of Parker Industries to me. And Peter's like, what are you talking about? I'm not going to do that. This is my company. And Otto says, I'm afraid not. It's actually my company because if you remember, this whole company was built while I was inhabiting your body. I'm responsible for Parker Industries. I'm responsible for its success. I'm responsible for most of the technology that was created. And he's kind of walking Peter through all of these moments where Peter thought, no, I did that or I was responsible for that. And he's making Peter question, like, I wonder if everything that's happened is because of Doc Ock to begin with. And so Doc is saying, so you can just turn the company over to me and, you know, we'll go about our ways. And of course he doesn't do that. And they get in a big knockdown, drag out fight that goes down the side of the building and outside. And as they're fighting, we see that there is another conflict back in New York. And this is where the dome has fallen over Manhattan. And Doc Ock has rigged it so that it looks like that there was some sort of thing that happened at Parker Industries that is the reason that this dome had just dropped over New York. And so now the company's looking bad again. The Avengers are calling and Peter basically has to let Doc Ock go in order to catch up with the Avengers. And when he does, he leaves the area. And as soon as he does, Doc Ock blows up the entire building of Parker Industries in London because his whole goal is to destabilize the company and take control of it while this whole Hydra thing is going on. And as we see toward the end of the book, he has a brand new face. He looks like a completely different guy. He's in shape now, and he is manipulating things behind the scenes in a way that is going to make him a major player in Spidey's world again. And that's the way the issue wraps up. Of course, Dan Slott is the writer. He is writing it with Christos Gage for this particular arc. Stuart Immonen is the penciler. Wade Von Grobadger is the inker. Marte Garcia is the colorist. And of course, Joe Caramagna on letters and Alex Ross on covers. Alex Ross has done the covers for pretty much the entire run of this book, and they have been phenomenal.
Alex Ross can't do anything wrong.
I mean, I would like a book when yes. it's done, because he's obviously not going to do them forever.
Yep.
My assumption would be that he would be doing them until they start renumbering the books in the fall.
And I'm hoping that he is part of that group too.
I'm assuming he'll be part of like the first couple issues or something, but I'm going to guess that this volume of Amazing Spider-Man is what his covers will have been for. And I would love for them to just put a hardcover together of just the covers.
Yeah.
I pay $15 for a hardcover of just the covers of his Amazing Spider-Man run. But this, again, is sort of bringing back to the surface the fantastic work that Dan Slott has done with Doc Ock in building him up as a foe that stands right next to the Green Goblin as far as Spidey's all-time greatest foes. And I just love that Slott's run on Spidey has really given us this awesome version of Otto Octavius, and I'm glad that he's back. So I was pleasantly surprised because I thought this was going to be just kind of a tie-in issue where I didn't know what was going on. Turns out that's issue number 30.
Yeah.
So that's why I focused on issue number 29.
I really like that. I like the fact that you're getting a tie-in, but you're not getting it so based on the events going on in Secret Empire proper.
What I found was that for issue number 30, it picks up like after the battle that's happened in New York or whatever, and there was a lot more of me saying, what just happened and why are all these heroes here and what's Spidey doing here? This one stood on its own.
Nice. So speaking of Secret Empire, this is a series that I have been picking up. I'm going to talk about number 5 right now. And I've actually really, really enjoyed this.
Again, pleasantly surprised, right?
I am a huge Captain America fan, but first and foremost, I want great stories and I want to have surprises and I want to have things. And we all know that the Steve Rogers that is running Hydra and declaring himself basically a Nazi is not the Steve Rogers that we know and love. We've always known that that is happening.
We've always, even before they showed their cards, suspected that there had to be some gimmick here. There had to be something.
And everybody, I think, has been saying that the Steve Rogers now, the Hydra Steve Rogers, is the ultimate Captain America. So this is the ultimate guy. And where is this Cap? Where has our Cap been hiding? I have always thought he never came back from Rebirth, that was how they were going to write it.
Oh, okay.
I've always thought that. And
but
now,
have they confirmed that detail yet?
I think something might have happened in the story
Well.
So Secret Empire number 5, written by Nick Spencer. Andrea Sorrentino is the artist. Additional art, Rob Rice, Joshua Karras, Rachel Rosenberg, letters by Travis Latham. And the editor on this one, oh boy, not going to find it. Wow, they've got, Tom Brevoort, I should have guessed. Tom is great at keeping everything together. So this book, before we even start, you and I and everybody on the planet has been bagging on Marvel for their prices. Oh, it's a number one, you're going to pay $17, and then number two will be a $3.99. So I went and picked up 4 and 5 at the same time because I missed 4. So I picked them both up. And when I went up there, I dropped out. I had my $10 ready because or $12 because I figured $5.99 each because these are double-sized books. And it came to $8, $8-something. And I flip it over. I'm like, well, I know I get a discount. But I flipped it over, and I saw that each book, Brian, $3.99. So that is a huge thing for Marvel. Thank you for listening to what the majority of people have been saying. I don't know when it flipped, because the last two issues I bought were $3.99. And again, these are fat books. There's a lot of stuff in here. And if we start diving right into the story, there is probably 10 to 12 stories going on within this arc. But I want to focus on maybe 2 or 3 of them because I want there to be some surprises. But we start the book out in Washington, D.C., and you have Madam Hydra, who is talking to all her Hydra dudes. And she's talking about the thing, and she's got a bunch of new people in there. And Hydra is big into getting the business community behind him so they can get their money,
sure,
much like Parker Industries. So Madam Hydra is talking about, you know, okay, so you surrender some of your stuff to us. You become a Hydra company, and we'll give you not only guaranteed sales, but we'll give you this little thing. So you've got all these businessmen that are like talking to each other, thinking, what do? We don't know what's going on. All of a sudden, Hydra drone comes, number one comes in and says something about, you know, you need to come see me right now. So Madam Hydra walks out and she's like, what did you just pull me out of that meeting for? And he goes, you're not going to believe this. We just captured Black Widow. And you've got Black Widow and Chain sitting there in a chair. And she, you know, Madam Hydra's like, so Natasha, what's going on? And she's like, Viper, it's been a long time. You know, I just want you to know that I will tell you whatever you want to know. And Madam Hydra's like, I don't understand why you're making this so easy.
This isn't how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I'm supposed to beat the crap out of you and you're supposed to tell me. Meanwhile, you see the sort of Young Avengers team that's been put together going in to try to get in, because everybody's now on the hunt for certain people that have clues or they actually have a shard of the Cosmic Cube. Now, the Cosmic Cube, yes, you know, you're going to hide one in Wakanda. That makes sense. You're going to have another piece. You're going to hide it in, you're going to hide it in Atlantis. These are places that make complete sense. But you're going to start seeing a couple characters show up here where you're thinking, why did they get that piece? That doesn't make any sense at all. But it makes sense if you're trying to hide it. So the soldier that came in punches Natasha in the face 3 or 4 times and says, well, I don't care if you're going to tell us everything. My job is to torture. So he starts smacking her around. And she goes, why would you hit me if I told you I was going to cooperate? And she goes, you know, there's a Hydra transport ship heading for a planned operation. And she goes, so why are you telling me all this stuff? Why are you telling me what I already know? And she goes, I'm telling you all this because I want you to help us take out Captain America. So what Natasha did was got herself captured, brought herself in, and is now trying to flip Viper over and telling Madam Hydra herself, or she's not Madam Hydra, the other one. She's telling Viper, if you help us, we're going to be able to maybe work with you. You can have your little piece of Hydra, but we can't have them running the world. This isn't going to work. Now, if you know anything about bad guys, and I know you do, Brian, bad guys are easily manipulated.
Oh, I know a thing or two about bad guys.
They're easily manipulated. You know, if you got 3 bad guys in a room, 2 of them are going to turn on one, and then one's going to turn
on
the other.
Evil usually does turn on itself, yes.
So that is what Natasha is kind of banking on. So she's telling her, you know, you could be the supreme leader of Hydra, or the supreme leader of Hydra is going to find out that you and I had this discussion, and then you're going to be in trouble with them. So you need to figure out what's going on. She pulls out a gun, shoots the 2 drone guys that are right next door, and now they're dead. So next we go over to you've got Rags Morales, Spider-Man, invisible on the roof or on the ceiling, walking by these 3 doctors.
I'm going to assume you mean Miles Morales.
Miles Morales. What did I say?
Rags Morales.
Rags could do it if he wanted to.
I thought, either maybe Rags Morales drew Spider-Man or something else is going on that I don't know about.
Rags got bitten by a radioactive spider.
Okay. I'll buy it.
Remember the time when we hung out with Rags at Main Vein?
Main Vein Comics in Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Remember my arm was all swollen and red?
Did not get superpowers, though.
No, did not get superpowers. I just got sick and some shots. So Miles Morales goes over the ceiling and he's going into an area and he comes into a place where there's this old guy on a ventilator and he's going, help me. And that's all you see of this guy. So now we see for a few pages, you've got Natasha and Viper kind of trying to broker a deal.
Negotiating.
This is where the story gets really, really cool. So in the 5 issues, you've sort of been introduced to a older blonde-haired guy with a beard, and you're assuming it's Steve Rogers. And he's walking around with a pretty fit black guy. You're assuming it's Sam Wilson the Falcon. And he's walking around with a young, dark-haired kid. You're assuming that's Bucky. So since I have read this, and then there's a panel in here where they're walking in the woods laughing. Now they're spearing fish. Then they're sitting by the fireside eating the fish. And now you see Steve laughing, and it says, peace. So as you've seen all these things, and this has gone on, and the cool thing too, Brian, I'll show you, is that the main part of the book is kind of colored and very kind of flat, very drab. Everything has almost a green tint to it. These are very colorful, very bright. So you're seeing that there's a lot of optimism and hope in this. My thought from the second I saw this is this is Steve Rogers' heaven. This is where he wants to be.
Huh.
He's with his
like
2
partners.
Like
that season of Buffy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm saying yes, and I don't even know what you're talking
right.
about.
Right. Yeah, no.
I've seen 1 episode of Buffy, and it had a grilled cheese sandwich in it.
Okay.
To me, this is Steve Rogers' mind, and this is where he's at peace. This is exactly where he wants to be. So I saw that. I'm like, holy crap. I put
spending
two
the
together.
Afterlife with his 2 best buddies.
Yep. So meanwhile, we have all this sort of political wranglings going on with Atlantis and with Tony Rogers. So Tony Rogers goes up to speak to Namor and tells Namor, Namor tells him, yeah, you know what? That piece I didn't give him, I gave to Hydra. So you guys are kind of out of luck. Now they start trying to track down the other pieces, and they find out that a piece is in the hands of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu.
Oh.
Which is an odd one, because that's that kind of...
Has he been a part of a team lately? Because no. I haven't been following.
Nope. That's where I was like, that is a great idea. You might as well put one on Howard the Duck. You know, all these characters that are kind of out of the consciousness. So they break in, they find him, he's all tied up, and they're like, oh, wait, we got you. And he's like, why are you guys here to rescue me? And they're like, because you have something that we want, and, you know, you're kind of a friend, but you have something. And he goes, you know, they tortured me, but I told them I didn't have it. And they're like, what do you mean you don't have it? And he goes, I don't have what you're looking for. And they're all looking at each other going, how do you not have it? And he goes, I don't know where it went. And then you see a flashback of him passed out, and you've got Emma Frost saying, White Queen to base, you know, a package secure. And you see her grabbing it off of his body.
And then she did like a mind wipe on him? Oh.
So now, and this is where I thought the story got really good on this part of it. All of a sudden you have the team go, all right, mission's over. We can't do this anymore. They were banking on that one piece to try to even things out, because they're still looking for a couple pieces to make this thing work, where they can maybe bend reality back to what they want it to be. So they have a moment with Shang-Chi. They're talking to him. You go to DC. You've got Cap and the Beast having a moment as they're standing in front of Thor's hammer that is just sitting there, because even Thor now can't pick it up. Nobody can pick it up. And that, to me, is sort of that reminder of, yeah, dude, Captain America, Steve Rogers picked it up. This guy can't pick it up. It's not the same person. So they have some moments. They talk about what their future is going to be. You get Vision and Scarlet Witch have some moments. Then you see Thor, or I don't even know what they're calling him right now, because Thor is Jane Foster now.
But it's Odinson.
Odinson.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So he's talking. He's basically kind of having a breakdown, saying, Father, what do I need to do to fix this? I've lost Jane Foster. I've lost everything. I've lost my connection to you. I don't have that feeling of Asgard anymore.
I screwed up, Dad.
I don't know what to do. And that's where that part ends. So right now you're seeing kind of the good guys are having their Empire Strikes Back moment.
Sure.
And you're also having some of the bad characters realizing, I might not be on the right side of this one. A couple other things are happening, which I don't want to talk about, because again, if you're reading this and you haven't read this, I don't want to blow a lot. But one of the cool – so the two cool things I want to talk about is the way that sort of the scenes with Cap and who I think it's Bucky and with Sam play out is you've got them walking in the woods and they're talking about things that they remember. And they're kind of vague with their memories. Like Steve's like, you know, I remember doing those things like fishing and hanging out and just feeling really good. And I just don't know any more than that. I just know it feels good. And then you've got Bucky talking about, you know, the fish were really small when we caught them. But you know what? Next time we can get better fish. And then Falcon looks up or one of the other dudes happens to look up and sees sort of like these laser traces in the trees. And, you know, he goes, hey, do you guys see that? And then one of them that looks like Bucky looks up. He steps on something. The Falcon guy gets caught in a trap and gets sent right up into the trees. And then you've got Bucky get an arrow in the neck, and I'm assuming it's Bucky. And then you get Cap get thumped on the back of the neck, and he turns around and he's like, no, please. And he said, and the voice off camera says, there's no need to be afraid, old friend. After all, I'm your salvation, don't you see? And you turn the page, and it's freaking Red Skull.
Oh.
Who has been kind of missing in this whole thing. You know, you saw him at the beginning, but he's been kind of missing. And he's there with his, you know, hack/ hammer with the nails on it.
So do you feel like this is him going into the consciousness of Steve Rogers and basically pulling him out of this dream
wherever
state,
he is.
Wherever he is, yeah.
Because he says the Red Skull is going to free you from this place, Herr Rogers. So I think that's where it's been the whole time. And when I first saw this and thought of this, that was my thought was, most people
kind of the Joker Batman thing of like Red Skull saying, I need my old adversary back. Yeah.
And the thing is with this part, you're kind of getting the fact, like if you remember, I want to say the last issue of Rebirth was late. Captain America Rebirth. if you remember, it was late. And the next arc kind of started, like the Captain America number one came out before Rebirth even ended. And a lot of people don't even remember and kind of put that in the back burner of their brains. Almost like, you know what? It never happened. I'm just not even going to think about that. I think that they're banking on the fact that a lot of people don't remember that. It's not in their thoughts. So I think that that's where he is. I think he's still hooked up on a table, almost in a coma, where he was before, and Red Skull is going to bring him out.
Interesting.
But the other part in here, too, is you see that they're talking about Cap. The Hydra Cap is saying, you know, we need to end this, and I have a way to end it right now. And then you have you see a big thing of the Hulk.
Oh.
And then you have somebody sitting at a table going, Steve. And it says, Bruce Banner, good to see you, old friend. So Hydra has captured Bruce Banner. I'm wondering who the old dude is on the table, and I'm wondering if that old dude on the table is Steve Rogers. Because when Miles Morales went in, there was an old dude hooked up on a table to a ventilator. I'm wondering if that is the body of Steve Rogers.
Huh.
So I'm going to have to go back. I think my assignment today is going to be go back and reread Captain America Rebirth and see if it fits.
Perhaps an Out of the Long Box is not far away, Matthew.
Could be.
Interesting.
So if you haven't picked this one up, I kind of recommend, if you can find them, go back and get it, because it is a lot better than I think people are giving it credit for.
Well, and I think the whole, you know, Red Skull and reaffirming that sort of legacy villain. I just talked about Dr. Octopus, and now we're going to talk about issue number 150 of Venom. This is all leading us to Marvel's bringing things back to basics sort of thing. And if I was going to say, if there were to be a classic incarnation of Venom, Matthew, what would your expectation be of that incarnation?
Isn't it Eddie Brock?
Eddie Brock is the...
Eddie Brock, the bad guy in the black suit.
So I think, though, they're going to take it one step further. Eddie Brock, Venom Lethal Protector. Remember that series long ago?
Oh, yeah.
The whole
yeah.
idea of like Venom being the antihero.
Yes.
But, you know, we've had Mac Gargan as Venom.
And
we've had
Mac, that was a great one because
Flash Thompson.
He was completely psychotic, right?
Well, and that was during Dark Avengers.
Yes.
Then you had Flash Thompson, who's been the symbiote. And so then you just recently had that guy Lee at the start of this series who was the symbiote. But now Eddie Brock is back.
He's back.
Because Eddie orchestrated a plan to separate that guy Lee from the symbiote and to get it to come back to him. And it was a plan that was years in the making. But now he has the symbiote back. And as we start this issue, which is an oversized 150th issue, it is a $6 cover price, but there's multiple stories in here. But the main one that I want to talk about is the one involving Eddie, because when you open up the first page, you kind of get a recap of how the symbiote bonded to Eddie in the first place. You've got the whole Sin Eater storyline where he, you know, lost his job and then his credibility was ruined. And you see, you know, the history of him and some of the other symbiotes there and the fact that he lost it for a while and how he never really recovered from that. And all of this is happening almost in like a nightmare and he wakes up from it. And that's immediately when you notice that the artist on this one is Trad Moore, who most recently did the Ghost Rider series is it Robbie Reyes who's the new Ghost Rider? It
yes,
was like the
Doom Buggy one.
Yes. And so, and Mike Costa is the one still writing it, but Trad Moore is the artist now. And so it's very expressive. And so you see Eddie is struggling with the fact that he's now rebonded with the symbiote, and the symbiote's talking to him saying, let's go out, Eddie. Let's drink in the moonlight. Let's go out. And he's like, fine, we'll go out. So he goes out and he starts swinging around. And as soon as he does, he notices that there is a break-in. And the symbiote saying, we have to stop them. And so he goes down and it's these guys breaking into a tech company looking for some biotechnology. And he gets in there and they're all wearing like these armored, almost like riot gear suits. And he beats the living crap out of them. But the whole time he and the symbiote are having kind of this tug of war of the symbiote is kind of pushing him to be more violent. And Eddie's kind of saying, these guys are thieves. We don't kill thieves. And the symbiote itself is like half agreeing with him and half not. It's because of all the different hosts that it's had and all the different stuff that it's been through. The symbiote kind of wants to be good, but has this dark side that's always pulling at it. And now that it's bonded with Eddie again, It's that same thing of wanting to be someone who does good, wanting to right wrongs, but also very easily going over the edge. And so they have this thing where he really basically destroys these thieves and he's not feeling good about it. And he goes back to the church that he originally bonded with the symbiote to. And he went in there and the church is very run down and there's a couple of thugs that come in there and he kind of chases them off. But then he runs into a pastor who's there and the guy comes out and talks to him and he says, you know, what brought you to this house? And he's like, oh, well, you know, I've been here before. And he's starting to talk a little bit. And the priest is basically saying to him, it sounds like you're in a relationship that maybe isn't that healthy. It sounds like you're talking about dealing with some real struggles. And the whole time he's talking, the symbiote is saying to Eddie, I don't like this guy. Because the priest is talking about, maybe this isn't the healthiest thing for you. And the symbiote's like, there's no way we're ever going to be separated again. And so you're seeing that Eddie kind of knows what he's gotten himself into. He has made a conscious choice now to rebond with the symbiote for better or for worse. And because he doesn't feel complete without it. And the symbiote is having its own identity crisis. And so it makes for one really unstable Eddie Brock. And he's talking to the priest and he ends up leaving the church, but not before there's a moment where you almost feel like the symbiote is going to make him kill the priest. So he leaves and he's walking down the street and who does he run into but the Scorpion. Mac Gargan, former wearer of the symbiote, picks a fight with him. The two of them start fighting. They're going back and forth. And there's a moment where the new augmentations that have been built into the Scorpion suit allow him to do like a sonic blast that kind of rips the symbiote off of Eddie. And Gargan is saying, I know this thing. I was this thing for a while. I know how to take this thing down. But the symbiote is saying to Eddie, he's afraid of it. So the symbiote kind of goes and makes a play like it's going to bond with Gargan. And Gargan is like so mentally scarred from having bonded with the symbiote before that he wants nothing to do with it. And so Eddie ends up escaping, but he passes out in the process because it's such an exhausting fight. And when he wakes up, he's back in the church again. And he's looking around and the symbiote is saying, we're safe now. We're bonded, Eddie. We're like, this is just like marriage. It's an important place to us. No one will break that bond between us. And as Eddie's looking around, he sees the body of the priest in the church. And he's like, what did you do? And the symbiote says, what we did, we are not going to let anybody come between us. And you turn the page and he's now cradling the body of the priest. And the symbiote is saying, no one will ever pull us apart again. And that's the way the issue ends. And so this to me, again, I really like what is being pulled together from the history of this character. Of course, people want Eddie Brock to be Venom. And it would be easy to just go back and have him be the Venom that hates Spider-Man. But what you're seeing here is an Eddie Brock and a symbiote that have both been through a lot since the last time they were together. And it makes for a whole new state of mind that they have to deal with. And I really, really like that. So Mike Costa-Tradmore killing it on this book. Felipe Sobrino is the color artist. Clayton Coles does the letters. And the editor is Devin Lewis. Now, you also get a backup story that kind of goes into a little bit how Flash Thompson lost the symbiote in the first place. And you also then get sort of a classic story of kind of Venom as the lethal protector who is trying to do good, but kind of takes it over the edge a little bit. And on top of that, you get a cover gallery that goes through all of the Venom covers dating back to the original miniseries all the way through the most recent series as well, which is how they get to issue number 150, I believe. So overall, if you're a fan of Venom or if you're a fan of the Eddie Brock Venom, great package. Like, this is the time to get back on this book now because it promises to be more than just the meat and potatoes Venom that we had back in the day, but really is kind of pulling on that character's now long history. So
I like seeing the cover because the cover is very reminiscent just because of the is that the right hand side? The right hand side color, you know, the little emblem on the bat on the side. It looks so old school and I like that.
And the cool thing too is like the way that this book is colored and I said you mentioned that Tradmore does the artwork on here. There's a moment where Venom is kind of out and about swinging over the city and it almost looks like the animated series.
Oh, it does.
Real quick. So it's really, really got a lot of nods to what has come before. Really good stuff. So Venom, I've enjoyed the series since it relaunched and this is now bringing it really back in line with the history of Eddie Brock. So great stuff. So those are your new books for this week. And now, Matthew, it is time to continue our summer reading project, or the Summer of Dread, as we have been calling it thus far. We are, of course, reading from the Complete Case Files of Judge Dredd, Volume 1. And the last time we left off, we were about to get into some Olympics.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you think about this time. When this book came out, this story came out about 1980. And in 1980, what was going on in the world was we had the Summer Olympics going on in Los Angeles. And in that time, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. That set the world on a very, very, very thin rope. People were coming very nervous, thinking, all right, here goes the Soviet Union again. The anger and venom caused the Soviet Union to pull out of the Olympics in the United States. Or no, we pulled out. It wasn't Los Angeles, it was Moscow. The United States pulled out. So there became this huge, huge issue of us versus them. And back then, too, if you weren't old enough to remember, and this is what I love about this story in particular, you had such a preconceived image of communism.
Right.
Because you didn't see it every day. You
right,
know what?
Right.
You know when you saw Russians? Every 4 years. You saw West Germany every 4 years during the Olympics.
Right.
And you looked forward to it. And I remember asking my dad. And my dad gave me a very basic thing of communism, which might not have been the best way to explain it. I said, why are they different than us? What's communism? And my dad goes, you know how you like playing hockey? And I go, yeah. And he goes, well, if you were really good, they would make you play hockey the rest of your life. That's all you would be doing. The government would tell you that's what you're doing. So if all the
after that speech, did he go, Wolverines?
But the problem was, I thought, there's nothing wrong with that. I really think – and it made me study communism to the point where I was a sixth grader reading the Communist Manifesto.
Hockey every day.
Going, this is not that bad. But obviously what communism was supposed to be is not what it
ended up. He regrets that conversation now.
We've talked about that. And he's like, yeah, I probably should have said something a little different. But this really goes back to that very Cold War feel that – for you know, the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 1968 – up until then, it was kind of quiet. And then you had this again. So opened up a lot of old wounds.
So in these stories, this is essentially a two-part story. But really, the first one is focusing on the Lunar Olympics. And of course, you have the Luna 1 team and the Saab Cities team that are facing off in the first Lunar Olympics. And as you mentioned, you know, very sort of archetypical depictions of the different teams here. But there's going to be Olympics on the moon, right? And so the cool thing about the Olympics on the moon is with the gravity situation, we're going to be setting some world records.
Huge records.
So, and it's funny because they're talking about like, we're going to shatter the Earth records. Yeah,
you should.
I'm going to guess that you probably should shatter that. But right off the bat, so you have judges from the Luna cities and you have judges from the Saab cities. And right off the bat, you see that Judge Dredd does not get along with the judges from the Saab cities. And so as soon as he starts walking around, because he's head of security here, he sees that there's already a problem with one of the Olympians.
Yes.
And they're being accused of having illegal drugs in their body or having too much cybernetics. And right off the bat, they're doing like bio scans on this guy. And it turns out that according to these judges, he's almost all cyborg.
He's less than 20% human.
And you're not supposed to have more than 20% cybernetics to be qualifying for these Olympics. And you're not supposed to use certain substances. And so right away, they find a cheater. The Saab City's judges show no mercy and take this guy out of here. And so you just get a quick taste of the fact that Judge Dredd is like, these guys are going to be trouble. They're already causing trouble.
And that was always the thing. Like you would look at the – you'd always look at the Eastern Bloc countries and go, dude, they're all on steroids. They're all – like you even have – if you look at the second panel where you've got the woman flag holder, she is what you would have expected of that Eastern Bloc woman athlete that was bigger than the other dudes because she was juicing.
Yep. And so then we cut over to some of the actual Olympic events that are going on. So the pole vault, a 60-meter pole vault, the first guy does. Then you have the shot put.
Shot put rules.
And one of the shot put what do they call them? The shots.
Yeah.
Goes right into the crowd and basically destroys a guy out in the crowd. So you're seeing like this sort of humorous, as we've found in some of the other case files, look at what these events would be like on the moon. So you have somebody doing a dustboard thing where it's basically like the ski jump. And he comes flying down, except he overshoots the catch nets And he ends up face planting and destroying himself. Now, this is Brian Bolland, if I'm not mistaken,
yes.
Correct? He ends up completely destroying himself, like his face and his body, just absolutely awful.
And sadly, Brian, his scores reflect it.
Yes. And so for probably killing himself, he ended up getting a 3.6, 2.5, 4.7. So you're seeing a lot of that back and forth, and you're seeing that it's been a very close Olympic game so far, but there is a last race to happen between the Sov cities and Luna 1. And so you've got a couple cybernetically enhanced racers, and they're going for it, and the Sov cities racer is going to win. He is heading towards the finish line. He's about to cross the tape. But before he does, all of a sudden, he gets vaporized into a pile of ash, and the Luna cities racer crashes through the tape, and he wins. So now you have the Sov City's judges who are saying, you know, this is completely out of order. And while that's happening, Judge Dredd finds the judges have tracked down the shooter. And when they've tracked down the shooter, they're going to execute that person right then and there. And Judge Dredd is saying, hold on a second. Let's kind of figure out what's going on here. And they don't want to wait.
We're not as violent on the moon.
Right.
Because he brings that up. He's like, the death penalty, we don't do that here.
Right. And so they're saying, you're soft. And we're going to kill this guy. And he has to end up shooting the gun out of one of their hands. But the bullet ricochets and kills one of the Sov City's judges. And so when that happens, the other one says, first, something happens to our sprinter. Now one of our judges gets killed. You know what? These are acts of open aggression. And we're now at war.
Yep.
And that's the way the first story ends, is that Judge Dredd has caused an interlunar incident that is going to result in a war. So you're like, holy crap. Like, freaking war now coming off of this.
Seven pages that could have easily been turned, and it was later on, turned into like a two or three story arc.
Right. And
that
so
whole Olympic thing.
Then we go into the second part of this arc, and you have the Sov City's soldiers who are waging war against the Luna City's soldiers.
What a great picture, isn't that?
It's amazing, except that war is not exactly what you think that it's going to be.
It is really interesting because when you are thinking of a war, you're thinking, all right, these are the first four of like a million guys behind
them.
Well,
and we saw the war between the robots and the humans back on Earth,
and
right? So you're thinking it's just all out mayhem.
Yep. And like you think of the block wars. You think of the block wars where it's a million people in a building trying to kill another people in another building. But you find out here because you have like in the Olympic one, you had a sports commentator kind of narrating your way through it. In this one, you have sort of that late 70s, early 80s reporter talking about this is what's going on, and he fills in the rules and basically explains to you that a all-out war is going to be four soldiers on each team.
And one reserve. So basically they just pick teams and
– And whoever literally is the last man standing wins the war. I'm thinking, you know what? Why are we not fighting wars that way anyway?
And whoever wins the war gets to take territory from the team that loses. And so that's basically what the stakes are here as far as space on the moon.
Yeah.
And as we start off, you have the Sov City's team that has better armor, better weapons, and is absolutely putting the Luna team on its heels. They have guns that they shoot out these like squiggly rays
that go through walls.
They go through walls and then they blow up.
Yep.
And so right off the bat, one of the Luna City's team dead gets absolutely killed. And they're freaking out right away. Like, holy crap, where are these guys getting these weapons? They're amazing. Our bullets don't even go in their armor. They just bounce off and they're just absolutely destroying our armor. Like technologically, they are completely outgunned. And then they find out that on top of that, their reserve teammate was shot with some sort of a tranquilizer dart, and that person can't even compete.
Yep.
And so who happens to be standing around but the head of security, one Judge Joe Dredd.
Yes.
And he says, you got yourself another reserve.
And this was – you talked about the archetype. This goes back to the archetype of the Soviet soldier. Better equipped, better weapons, and they were looked at as – they were going to be the conquerors of the world. You know, they were looked at almost as modern day Nazis back in this day. So it is. And again, when you're in England, we lived in the United States. We were so much further away. England wasn't that far from the Soviet Union. So there was a lot of fear being that close to everything. And you got a baseball umpire calling the war.
Right.
Which I thought was amazing,
yes,
too.
Yes, making sure that people follow the rules, yes, of the war. And so what Judge Dredd decides to do is he's going to throw his hat in the ring now. He's going to join up with this team. And, of course, from a confidence level, he kind of stabilizes things. This is what we're going to do. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. He figures something out about the weapons, but he doesn't reveal it till later. And this is kind of something that we've seen in other stories with Dredd figuring out the weakness of his adversary and then sort of using that against them. And what he finds out is that, yes, certainly the weapons that the Luna team is using are not going to have any effect on the armor that the Sov Cities team is wearing. However, he is going to figure out a way to use their own weapons against them. And so in order to do that, he takes one of the other guys on the team and he says, drop your weapons. We're going to charge them. And so they do that. They come out of cover, they drop their weapons, and they charge straight at the Sov Cities team. And when the Sov Cities team fires on them, the lasers that they fire go straight through Judge Dredd and the other guy without doing any damage at all. And they get in close to melee these guys. They steal one of their weapons, and then they're able to use those weapons against them. And when they do, they're able to detonate them inside the impenetrable armor of the Sov Cities team and defeat them. And when Judge Dredd is talking afterwards, he's talking about how those weapons that they were using, they didn't detonate on impact. They detonated at a certain range. And all they had to do was move faster than the soldiers could adjust the range of that weapon, and the weapon would never detonate. And so once they stole the weapons, they detonated them inside the armor of the Sov Cities guys, and they defeated them. And then, of course, you have the commentator who just wants a recap of what a stunning victory that Judge Dredd had just orchestrated, and he ends up taking the microphone and shoving it in this guy's mouth. And
literally.
Says, listen, you folks at home, today we want a piece of Sov Cities dirt. So what? Three good men died to do that. That's what matters. And so he says, sometimes war is necessary, but don't ever let these creeps like this tell you that it's fun. War is pointless. War is evil. War is hell.
And this is where Brian Bolland was a big fan of war comic artist Russ Heath. Their styles are exactly alike. And back in those days, all the DC war comics used to end with a little logo thing that said, make war no more. So that, to me, when I read that, and I remember reading it a bunch of years ago going, oh my gosh, that's like Make War No More.
Yep.
Super cool stuff. But and you know what? Let's get back to some crime.
Some crime and some twisted humor. Because
that's good stuff.
We have a heist that is being done at the First Lunar Bank. And it looks like Laurel and Hardy and is that Charlie Chaplin?
Charlie Chaplin.
Are the three bank robbers.
Yep, and they've got everybody in there. And what is interesting, so that you have they're standing there, and again, this is where Brian Bolland's art comes so clear, because you know exactly, even if you don't know who these guys are.
You know that they are someone that you recognize from television,
yes,
and from comedy.
Yep, and they're in there, and they're talking about, you know, fill the – and they're in their personas. You know, fill the bank up to the top, my good man.
Yeah.
And then when things start to go bad, when all of a sudden the judges show up, the police show up, they're talking about, we're trapped in here, Ollie. You know, this is another fine mess you've got us into. And if you know Laurel and Hardy, that's their sort of thing. So what you find out is that these three villains have face changers.
Right.
And when they storm the bank, the first thing that the police do is get everybody out of the bank, get all the hostages out of the bank. And that is where you see the former Laurel Hardy and Charlie Chaplin all have different faces. And you see them walking away as the Marx Brothers, holding on to the loot. And they've got a woman behind them, you know, a woman cop and another cop that are kind of pushing them through like, oh, my gosh, you poor.
Right.
Or they're ambulance
because they're
drivers.
Disguised as victims now.
Yeah.
And so they get ushered out of there and they carry this machine around basically in like a briefcase.
Yep.
And it's just this thing that they put over their head and it changes their appearance and then they can be whoever they want to be. And so, of course, everybody gets out of there. The police have no idea. The judges can't find who committed the crime. They get into where they thought that the gunmen were and there's nobody there. And Judge Dredd is like, man, let's look at this photograph of the people that were in here. I thought I recognized those faces. They're all 20th century comedians. And he's like, they've got a face changer machine. So, of course, Dredd is the one who deduces what happened right away. And then he ends up arresting these guys. And when he does, or he ends up arresting three guys who bought this technology that he knows to be criminals. So he brings them in and he's interrogating them. And as they're interrogating them, none of these guys are talking. They're all like, I don't know what you're talking about. We had nothing to do with that. They're all got their story straight and everything. And we want our lawyer. And Dredd says, okay, I guess they're not going to talk. Bring in their lawyer. So they bring in the lawyer, and the guy's name is Manny Bloom. And they bring in the lawyer, and the lawyer is, of course, trying to rip Dredd a new one, saying, you know, you're harassing my clients. They didn't do anything, blah, 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 blah. And he gets them released. And he says to the three guys, he says, you guys go get in the car. I'm going to give this judge a piece of my mind, and then I'll be out and we can get out of here. And so him and Judge Dredd are going at it. And then a few minutes later, the lawyer walks out and gets in the car and says, great job, guys. I think we're all set. Let's go back to the house and celebrate and blah, blah, blah. And they go back to the house and all the guys are talking about, oh, what a great heist we pulled, right? Wasn't that so awesome? And we used this technology and everything. And then, of course, you have the lawyer who stands up and says, this conversation's been recorded. You're all under arrest. Because when the lawyer stayed behind, Judge Dredd made him stay at the police station and used the face changer at justice headquarters to make himself look like the lawyer. So he went back and he had these guys confess, and then he arrested them all.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, now you creeps are going to get one last face change. There's a look a con gets when he's done 40 years on a dome repair gang. Kind of sad, kind of empty, and it ain't pretty.
Nope, never is.
And that's the way this particular story ends.
Three awesome ones.
Very, very good ones. Yeah, really good. And we're getting towards the last sort of couple sections of the Judge Dredd case files, but we're going to take a break from that for next time, because for next time, we're going to do the second installment of our summer watching project, which is going to be the Judge Dredd Super Fiend animated series. So check the show notes for this episode, because in those show notes, you are going to see the link that you can get to the YouTube playlist that will have all, I believe, six episodes. It's five or six of this Super Fiend series, and they're short.
I've never seen it.
The whole thing's like a half hour
long. Cannot wait.
But it's think of it as almost like a liquid TV sort of thing, like the Max or the Head or something like that. It's kind of like in that vein, but it's super cool. So that is your assignment for your summer project next time. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian LaTenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.